I guess we are ready to call our second case for the day, Waterwell v. Consolidated Insurance Company, 1480-2484. Counsel, are you ready to begin? Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court, my name is Tim Hansen. I represent Waterwell. Under even the strictest application of the Four Corners Rule, was entitled to a defense in this case. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals and hold Consolidated breached its duty to defend. The underlying complaint in this case alleges essentially that Waterwell supplied product and installed a well pump for the Waukesha Water Utility. It alleges the well pump was negligently installed and that the well pump fell. And as a result, damages were paid by Argonaut, an insurance company for the utility. The complaint is confusing as to what product was supplied by Waterwell and what product was damaged in this fall and what product may have been repaired or replaced using the proceeds from the Argonaut policy. The complaint defines the well pump, capital W, capital P, to include various items in paragraph 8 of the complaint.
Counsel, we have two complaints here. One is yours against the insurance company.
Correct.
And the other is the complaint against you. So when you talk about the complaint, it would help me if you tell me which complaint you're talking about.
Thank you, Justice Abramson. I will refer to this, the underlying complaint or the Argonaut complaint.
Good.
Refers
okay.
to the first complaint filed, not against my
right.
client, Waterwell.
Okay.
So the underlying complaint defines Waterwell to include, but not limit to, certain items, pipes, screws, coupling, pump, etc. In other words, there are more components that constitute the well pump than are described in the complaint. The complaint also describes work done by Waterwell and identifies some of the items that are defined in the well pump definition, but also mentions additional items, including check valves, flow sleeves, and airlines. Again, that is all prefaced with including but not limited to. The complaint describes subsequent reinstallations of the well pump, again mentioning some but not all of the products identified in the definition. So the point of reciting some of that information from the underlying complaint is that it is not clear what products constitute the well pump. It is not clear what products were supplied by Waterwell, or what products were damaged when the well pump fell, or what products were repaired and replaced, if any. That was the complaint, the underlying complaint, that Waterwell tendered to the Consolidated and requested a defense. In response, Consolidated chose the riskiest option. It made its own unilateral coverage determination based only on that complaint and said there was no coverage. It used that unilateral coverage determination to conclude, therefore, there was no duty to defend. Consolidated acknowledges that there was an initial grant of coverage. In other words, property damage is a covered occurrence in this CGL policy. So Consolidated, in deciding there was no coverage, relied solely on two exclusions to coverage. The your product and the your work exclusions. If coverage is even possible, and when I say coverage, I mean the duty to indemnify. If indemnification or coverage is even possible or arguable or fairly debatable, even under the current Four Corners rules, Consolidated will have breached its duty to defend. We look at that duty in deciding whether an insurance company has a duty to defend. We liberally construe the allegations in the underlying complaint. All reasonable inferences are assumed in favor of Waterwell, the insured. And any exclusion, here the your product and your work exclusions, are narrowly construed.
Counsel, one thing that interested me was count one of the complaint, paragraph 18, where it's alleged that
Waterwell, its agents, employees, and representatives had a duty to reasonably and prudently install, configure, on and on. And I know it's your argument that there was an independent contractor. Now, without looking outside the four corners of the complaint, is it your position that the description of who is the actor here is ambiguous, or because they are the, quote, agents, employees, and representatives of Waterwell, there really isn't an ambiguity? It's all their conduct that's at issue.
In my view, there's no ambiguity.
There's no ambiguity.
When the third-party complainant in the underlying Argonaut complaint chose to write the words employees, agents, and representatives, it intended different meanings. An agent is different than an employee, so an agent can be a third-party subcontractor.
I maybe didn't phrase my question well. What you're saying to me is this can include more than just Waterwell itself, is your answer.
Yes, I misunderstood your question.
Yeah, I probably didn't put it together too well, but I understand your position.
Yes, I think we're in agreement, Chief Justice, that there is an express allegation in the underlying complaint that someone other than Waterwell, potentially, performed work on the well project.
Okay, so even within the four corners, I don't need to look at other evidence, I don't need to look at an exclusion.
Nope.
It's your position that there's a grant of coverage.
There's a grant of coverage, but even if you were not looking at extrinsic evidence, but still were considering exclusions,
right,
we still would defeat the exclusion, because exclusion has an exception for cases where subcontractors are
are doing it. Okay.
And another reason why that's important, and I don't mean to jump too far ahead, since we're talking about the your work exclusion, I'll just go forward. If you look at American Family versus American Girl, the Supreme Court, Wisconsin Supreme Court case from 2005, paragraph 68, it's complex facts and procedural history, but the significant point about paragraph 68 is CGL policies back in the old days used to exclude, they had a your work exclusion, similar to the your work exclusion here. The problem was that when subcontractors were getting involved in more and more construction projects over the years, general contractors weren't able to insure for the risk. So they complained somehow and convinced the insurance companies in 1986 to rewrite the exclusion to include an exception for subcontractors. So I think when you look at the law behind the your work exclusion, without resort to any extrinsic evidence and giving full credit to the exclusion to consolidate it, you still, under that rubric, and especially when you look at exclusions narrowly, et cetera, it is absolutely the reasonable inference that subcontractors were involved in the construction project related to the well. And I don't see any reading of the your work exclusion, four corners or not, exclusion or not, what have you, we win on that one. Both because of the point you pointed out, Chief Justice Rogan-Sack, that it says agent specifically in the underlying complaint, and coupled with the fact that the CGL policies changed to make sure subcontractors were accepted from the exclusion.
Thank you. Counsel, what is the rule of law upon which the trial court or court of appeals erred, and what is the rule of law you want us to adopt? Now, were you here for the last oral argument?
I was.
Okay. This is similar in that it's a unilateral situation, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what is the rule of law you want this court to adopt as the rule of interpreting in a unilateral contract situation whether the insurance company has a duty to defend? That's an issue in this case, right?
It is. If you get past the simple error correction for the misapplication of the exclusions, then I do think that either an exception under the four corners rule to permit extrinsic evidence or a bar from considering the exclusions in the unilateral declination of the defense, you could get to those exceptions.
What's the general rule that we should be applying in the unilateral situation? In the other case, it was that if you have a duty to defend in a unilateral situation, the court should just look at the four corners of the complaint, right?
Correct.
And should just look at the coverage of the insurance policy, not exclusions, not exceptions. Is that the rule you want this court to adopt?
I think that if there is not any other, if the four corners rule is ironclad and without exception, then I do think you would need to adopt, in fairness, some sort of Grube estoppel rule and confirm that Grube and Radke and Kenefick stated the correct position, that in a unilateral duty to defend case where the insurance company makes its own unilateral determination of coverage and denies a duty to defend, they shouldn't be able then to use the exclusions to try to defeat coverage later. But I think that an easier solution potentially is to go back to Grebe and at least consider, under certain limited circumstances, permitting extrinsic evidence in the four corners rule. I think when you look at the four corners, the policy drivers behind the four corners rule, it was designed to help insureds get a defense. The four corners rule ensures that insurers do not frustrate the expectations of their insureds by doing what Consolidated did here, prematurely resolving coverage issues in their favor, based solely on the contents of a third-party underlying complaint.
Now, that was Judge Riley's position.
That's correct. Whether, you know, there's been a lot of debate about whether Grebe is still good law. I think whether it is or is not, and we can discuss that if the court's interested, but I think this court can fashion some narrow exception along the lines of what is laid out in Grebe that would answer, I think, the concerns of the majority in Sustache 1, the Court of Appeals case from 2007, and the dissent in Waterwell, because it would serve the purposes of the four corners rule, and I think it would avoid the bizarre situation here where rather than having the duty to defend be broader than the duty to indemnify, it's effectively been narrowed.
So what are the exceptions you would think the court should...
I would propose that when there are facts outside the underlying complaint that could trigger coverage that are known or readily ascertainable by an insurance company, it must defend. If not, if it chooses not to defend, despite known or readily ascertainable facts that could create a question as to coverage, the insured should be able to show those same facts to a court. Not to determine coverage, not a full-blown coverage trial where you can get all the underlying facts and a full-blown evidentiary record. Just enough to show that there is a question, that it is arguable, that coverage is possible. Almost as if the outside affidavit would be two or three additional paragraphs to the complaint. You could even limit that further to cases where the complaint, like it is here, is murky, it's ambiguous, it's confusing, or it omits facts relevant to a determination of whether coverage is arguable. That would have worked very well here.
When the complaint is filed, the plaintiff doesn't necessarily know what the insurance policy looks like. So it might be kind of difficult to do that. In our last case, it was asserted that if coverage is of concern to the insured, which it always seems to be, that the insured should then
file an action and seek a determination on coverage and ask the court to make that decision. Did you do that here?
I don't believe that that Waterwell sought a declaration of indemnity. It's not on the record, and I wasn't the lawyer below, so I don't know why that was done. But okay. I do have two quick responses.
Okay.
Number one, you're absolutely right that a third-party complainant won't know oftentimes whether there's insurance or what magic words they need to trigger it. And you would think in the ordinary course, a clever plaintiff would plead it in such a way as to potentially make coverage more likely.
Right.
But in this case, and in the self-defense cases, and in the privileged operation of motor vehicles cases, there's no reason one way or the other for a third-party plaintiff to include those facts. Number one, it would be unusual for someone who is suing for assault to allege that the person that hit him was acting in self-defense. So the self-defense exception to an exclusion in those policies would not be revealed from the face of the complaint. That was the problem in Sustash and Berg.
Well, they will want to get into the insurance policy because they want the dollars that are in the insurance company's pocket. So you would think that they would, if in good faith, they could allege that. The self-defense that you're talking about may be simply something they don't have knowledge of.
Right. But in that case, then, an insurer should be able to offer that extra paragraph of the complaint in the form of extrinsic evidence to say, it's not in the complaint, Mr. Insurance Company, but just so you know, my defense will be, when you defend me, one of the things you should defend me on is self-defense. But I think more importantly, in a case like this, there's no reason for the plaintiff, Argonaut, in the underlying case to have alleged independent contractors or subcontractors worked on the project, because Waterwell would be liable to Argonaut or the Waukesha utility whether there were independent contractors or not. So there's no real reason for them to include that in the complaint. Now, they happen to here because I think they were, you know, alleging what they could.
Well, they're wearing belts and suspenders, which is what,
right,
you know, pleadings are often do.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but in the situations where a complainant, a third-party complainant, would have no real compelling reason to make extra allegations, especially in a notice pleading state like Wisconsin, there should be an opportunity. Again, just in those limited situations where the fact is missing, where you could easily just show an insurance company, show a court, but for this one fact that the plaintiff didn't know about in the underlying case, or just forgot to plead, or just pled mistakenly, I can fix this whole thing right now. For insureds, it's great because it's very quick, it's very efficient. They are the ones in the best position to know the information. And it avoids, I wanted to get back to that second point. You asked about the insured starting its own
right.
second lawsuit.
Right.
Yes, you could do that. I think my option is much better, to simply file an affidavit. But you could do that. But that puts the burden, an incredible burden, on an insured to hire not only defense counsel.
Well, you know, the burden here, I think, is very interesting. It seems that there is a burden on the insured to show there's coverage in the first instance. Would you agree with that?
I agree with you under day.
Whose burden is it to show there's an exclusion and that no exception applies? Is it still the insured's or is it the insurance company's?
Under day, which admittedly is a coverage case, but
yeah.
the duty to defend is broader than coverage. Certainly,
yep.
if the burden shifts in a coverage situation, it would shift even more greatly in a duty to defend case. The burden would shift once the insured shows an initial grant of coverage, which is conceded here. The burden would or should fall to the insurance company to show that an exclusion applies.
Right.
Now, there are some cases that say that burden shifts back again to the insured.
If there's an exception to the exclusion.
Right. But if there's going to be a burden shift, how is an insured supposed to, you know, if you're looking at the entire four corners of the insuring agreement, if there's not a burden shift, then it's up to the insured only. There's a grant of coverage and an exclusion doesn't apply, but if an exclusion applies, there's an exception to the exclusion.
Yeah.
That burden's almost impossible to meet on the face of those two documents.
Right, unless you would file, somehow file an action within the main action as a pleading against the insurance company.
Yes, you could try to implead the insurance company and do it that way, but all of that leads to more litigation.
Yeah.
All of that leads to greater expense and cost on behalf of the insurer. And yes, there's the argument
that... Well, if
that
you win, though, they have to pick up your whatever they should have been paying when they denied coverage.
But then you're just made whole. You're in no better position than you were...
Well, if you get insurance coverage, you're in the position you want to be in, right?
Well, I know that there's this idea that you refuse to defend your own peril if you're the insurance company, but in many cases, I think that's a hollow risk to the insurance company, especially like it was here. Because, yes, you can lose your policy limits. You can have to pay the lawyer that was hired in the coverage fight by the insured, and you might have to pay the defense costs incurred by the insured that you should have been paying.
Right.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But if you act like Consolidated is here, you saved all the money by not defending. You saved all the money by not fighting coverage. And the penalty is just that
you got to pay what you should have. Yeah.
The only time there's a risk is if the policy limits are at issue. Well, the policy limits here we settle it for $80,000 roughly. It was a $300,000 claim, and I think the limits are $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So woe to the insured who is fortunate enough to be sued for too little, because then there's really no risk. There's no downside to an insurance company simply taking, especially where an insurance company knows or it has readily ascertainable to it facts outside the pleadings that could demonstrate a possibility of coverage. In that sort of situation, without the ability of the insured to say anything, The insurance company is always in a better position to deny everything.
Well, I think the standard readily ascertainable to the insurance company is a standard that will certainly promote litigation. Because if you say they knew, that, cool, I can see how that can be taken care of quickly. But if the standard you want us to use is readily ascertainable, I think that's a sticky wicket.
It may be, but I think it's less sticky than forcing an insured into multiple pieces of litigation, and I think in some ways this benefits the insurance company, because the insurance company should, rather than rely on a post-judicial reckoning of what was reasonable inference at the time when they're trying to bless, when they're asking court to bless their coverage determination and denial of defense, they get to look at facts. They can actually say, look, it's put up or shut up time if you're the insured. Give us an affidavit that demonstrates, again, not full-blown coverage here, just enough to demonstrate plausibility of coverage. It's under oath. It's subject to all the pleading rules in the state of Wisconsin. And now we've got your facts. It's put up or shut up time, insured. Wouldn't the insurance company rather have that information in that form that will help it make its determination as to whether it should defend, rather than rolling the dice and finding through a post-judicial review that it did breach its duty to defend, and now in big cases, it's coverage limits.
Yeah. Tell me about your bad faith claim. That's missing in your analysis here. I'm understanding your answer to the question to be, there's really no downside for the insurance company to save their money, put it in their pocket, not defend, and then maybe have to pay out what they would have had to pay out later. So the insured really isn't getting what they bargained for, because the insurance company has zero incentive to provide the kind of defense and possible coverage that they would have under the terms of the policy. But you alleged bad faith as well. Did you mean it?
We did. Well, yes. Waterwell meant it when it alleged bad faith, and I think it's because there were facts readily ascertainable, or so the theory would go. And yes, that is, maybe I overstated the no downside, and I apologize to the court. I didn't mean to go quite as far. There is always a risk, yes, that there will be a bad faith determination after the fact. But that is a difficult...
That gives you punitive damages. That gives you relief that you would not get under the contract, right?
Although, I think if the insurance company looked at the extrinsic facts submitted by under my theory, they would also avoid potentially bad faith claims, because even if they breached, if they still, in light of the affidavit, decided not to defend, they would then be on notice of those extrajudicial facts. In the absence of those facts, or if they could demonstrate they didn't know them, I don't think that there'd be a really good bad faith claim. But I think those bad faith litigation, again, it adds more litigation to the process rather than less. Those cases are difficult to prove, and I think, you know, I'm not speaking from the record or from the case law, which is my own experience. It's very rare to see bad faith and punitive damages against an insurer in Wisconsin. It happens, but to have that be the only penalty for an insurance company, to me, suggests that there really should be more risk. And I think that in the absence of meaningful, if that's the only risk, I still don't think that's sufficient in these cases, certainly not in this case, to not allow an insurer to simply say with one piece of paper, here's what you really need to know.
Do I understand the facts of this case to be there is a federal lawsuit that's the underlying lawsuit, right? And that's the one where your client was a defendant.
That
right?
is correct.
So that was filed in December of 13 sometime?
Something like that. I don't have the date with me.
And then you must have had communication with the insurance company, and by the end of December they said, for a variety of reasons, we're not in, right?
I believe the record reflects that there is correspondence to and from, but only.
So then instead of bringing them into that lawsuit, you got a separate state court lawsuit against the insurance company alleging the two counts,
correct.
Right? Why? I'm just curious. Procedurally, why did you do it that way?
I'm not sure, but my light's on. Sorry. But
you can answer the question.
No, that's okay. I think the most probable explanation in my mind, because I have thought about that, is that Waterwell was able to get out of that federal case for $80,000, and it just did it.
Yeah.
And it just took advantage of the fact it mitigated its own damages, and frankly, the insurance companies by doing that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I have a couple of questions for you. This unilateral, and you talked about what the rule should be, and if I understood it, the rule on the unilateral should be that you look at the four corners of the complaint and you look at the coverage provisions under the insurance policy, but you don't look at exclusions and exceptions. That's your general rule, but you think that's unfair and you may have to have some exceptions to that general rule. Have I stated that correctly?
My position was that in the absence of any exception
right.
to the four corners rule, then the other rule should be this two-track, the one that you've identified, just to say,
yes.
Right, and the bilateral, unilateral rule.
Yeah, so you agree with the two-track. This is a one-track case.
Yes.
Right? Therefore, you should just look at the four corners of the complaint and what does the policy say about who is covered and for what acts generally, right?
That is correct, although we win under, even if you include the exclusions.
Okay. Is this decision in this case consistent with the decision in the first case you were here when we heard that, the Marks case?
I believe it is. I think
on this issue. There are several issues in this case, but on this issue.
On the two-track issue, yes, they're consistent.
Yes, they are consistent. The other issues in this case are... are there limited exceptions to track one? And your answer there it was yes, for example, the Riley self-defense, but that there are others. Those are matters that are known or readily available to the insurance company. Okay.
Yes, yes.
Now I'm looking for what your third issue is, which is... at the duty to defend stage in a unilateral, the issue is whether an insurance company can rely on policy exclusion. And your answer to that would be no, except if it falls under one of your exceptions. Is that correct?
Essentially, yes. That would only need to be the rule. I think the law right now is not entirely clear, but that would need to be the rule in the absence of a limited grebe type exception.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
When an insurance company has unilaterally made the decision.
Yeah, those are all related, one, two, and three. They really ask the same question.
It is, although I do view bar of the exclusions by the insurance company as a potential alternative to the narrow exception under some type of greed exception.
And so you would go along with the two tracks with some exceptions?
I think so, yes. I think that there, something has to change or be clarified. Mm-hmm. There either needs to be the need greed or group. Mm-hmm. You need the GRs, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Thank okay. you.
Thank you very much.
May
Justice Cross question. Counsel.
Sorry.
I inferred from your comments that you thought our decision in Sustash was wrongly decided.
Sustash 2?
Yeah.
No, not at all. Sustash 1 just pointed out, Sustash 1, the Court of Appeals in 2007 believed that it was a duty to defend case. By the time it reached this court in Sustash 2, this court recognized that the insurance company in that case had undertaken the defense, and thus extrinsic evidence was introduced to reach a full determination of coverage on the merits. So I don't take issue with Sustash 2 at all.
You mean by Sustash 2 the Supreme Court?
Yes.
And Sustash 1 the Court of Appeals?
Yes.
So you think the Court of Appeals has a problem in that case?
I do. I think they felt constrained by what they understood the law to be under Grebe, and I think that the final concluding paragraph of Sustash 1 was imploring the court, this court, to take a look at this, and I think that my proposal, whatever you want to call it, a Grebe affidavit or this narrow exception, I think would solve the problem. And it would be an incremental change in the law. It wouldn't be a wholesale change. You wouldn't even need to necessarily say we fully adopt Grebe in all four exceptions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is William J. Cott of the law firm of Wilson, Elzer, Moskowitz, Edelman, and Digger, and I'm here with Christina Cott, who's also an attorney with our firm and is very involved with the writing of briefs in this matter. If this court is considering expanding the Four Corners test to allow for examination of extrinsic evidence, this is the wrong case to do. And the reason for that is this. There was no extrinsic evidence in this case at the time of the tender. The court looks at the record in this case. The tender letter tendering the defense of this matter to Consolidated was January 15, 2014, and that's in the record at number 12. At that point, there was no extrinsic evidence submitted whatsoever. The decision to deny the tender was based on solely that complaint, and we're talking about the underlying complaint, not the complaint in this case. So it was never, there was no extrinsic evidence. The extrinsic evidence they've talked about in their briefs, and when they continue to talk about an affidavit, is called the Judkins affidavit. And that's in the record at number 13. And the date on that is June 2 of 2014, 6 months after the tender, and it was only submitted in support of their summary judgment motion. So there's no factual record before this court on which to even say what kind of extrinsic evidence would you use, and to use their term, what was readily ascertainable. That term, from my experience in the insurance industry and defending insurance companies, is big enough to drive a truck through. It will only encourage litigation. If you think there is bad faith litigation now, which gets alleged in almost every coverage case, that term is going to open up a whole can of worms as to what's readily ascertainable. Ascertainable to who?
Yeah. Counsel, I want to ask you the same thing about all of this that bothered me with opposing counsel. And I looked to paragraph 18 of the complaint. And I'm looking at the Four Corners rule. And if I understand it, you look at the insurance policy in total, and you look at the complaint in total, and you evaluate them. Why isn't the allegation in paragraph 18 big enough to include subcontractors, which is an exception to your exclusion?
For one thing, subcontractor would be an independent contractor. They would not be an agent.
Well, and they could be a representative, couldn't they?
Well, if you look at this in context and you say they're agents, employees, and representatives, I think the common even with any kind of reasonable inferences, those are representatives of Waterwell for whom Waterwell can be vicariously liable. There is, you talk about an agent, a contractor is not an agent. You talk about an employee is not an agent. If you use the term representative in that context with those two terms, and that's a common term used in a complaint when you're talking about any kind of a company, I don't see how you can read into that that, oh, they're talking about some subcontractor when all you have is the complaint. There's nothing to indicate that. And to me, the biggest part about this is if you look at this complaint, they keep talking about the complaint being ambiguous or confusing. This is a notice pleading state. Yes. This is one of the most specific complaints I've ever seen.
Well, we are notice pleading, but that doesn't mean sometimes complaints aren't ambiguous and can't be construed both ways and still comply with notice pleading.
I totally agree. I'm not saying that. I say this goes beyond notice pleading. I take the opposite position. This is not an ambiguous complaint. Why? And this is another reason this is not a good case to extend the extrinsic evidence. What does it say? It tells you who was involved. It talks about Waterwell. It talks to you about the pump. And it names components. It says including but not limited to, like talking about a car, saying the spark plugs, the tires, the steering wheel. It talks about components. It talks about what Waterwell did, install, reinstall. And then to me, the key paragraph is right before, I think it's 14, where it says they failed to put two screws in. Pretty specific, that Waterwell failed to put two screws in. And then what happens? The pump falls to the bottom of the well. When you talk about the your work exclusion and the your product exclusion, both of those start with the sentence of property damage due to your work, property damage due to your product. And there's not one allegation in this complaint that there was any property damage to anything other than Waterwell's pump. That's why a reading of this is actually quite simple from this standpoint, and why, in fact, Consolidated could deny the duty to defend based simply on the pleadings. I think the court, from its own cases, can see that kind of decision is relatively rare. This isn't a decision that gets made very often where you do it just on the pleadings. And they had such a specific complaint here that said who, what happened, cause, what the damage was, that they could look at this and say, you know what? Under the four corners test, this simply does not fall within the insurance policy. There's one other point I'd like to make on the four corners test.
What are we talking about? The four corners of the underlying complaint?
Yes.
You don't want to look at the four corners of the insurance policy.
Well, I've never heard it referred to as the four corners of the policy, but when I'm talking about the entire policy, I would agree with you.
Pardon me?
I would agree if you look at the entire policy.
In the entire, so you look at the exclusions and the exceptions,
absolutely,
too?
Absolutely. It's a contract. This court has said in many cases that insurance contracts are interpreted like regular contracts.
Well, is that what the Court of Appeals did here?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
They made their decision based on the exclusions. You have a case, I can give you an example. I have a case right now with an asset purchase agreement. And there's specific limitations in there that indicates we're not taking the liability. Why wouldn't you take the liability? And that's the same thing we're doing here. There's a limitation on liability with exclusions.
So you think the same rule applies to the unilateral contract and the bilateral? That is, if the insurance company came in and asked for a ruling.
I appreciate the distinction, and I respect the distinction, Justice Abramson, you're making between unilateral and bilateral. But I think that is more a procedural distinction than an analytical distinction in terms of what you do.
That's why I'm asking you, because apparently some think it was substantive all the time and others think that was a mistake. So your position is you look at the entire insurance policy.
You always... Yes.
That's fine. I understand that. So it doesn't matter whether it's unilateral or bilateral.
No, the only question is what facts are you applying?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so like in the duty to defend stage,
right,
which I find it interesting, they want to say, let's look at the facts of their duty to defend stage.
Mm-hmm.
The four corners rule was designed to protect the insured so they didn't have to rely on facts. How many quotes do we have in the cases that say, whether the allegations are meritless or fraudulent or specious. It's designed to protect the insured so they don't have to have all the facts. We assume the facts to be true, and then you look at that, and you make a determination looking at the whole policy. When you get to the second kind of analysis, the only difference is now you have different facts, but you're still looking and comparing to the whole policy. It's still a contractual interpretation.
So can you bring in extrinsic evidence, like on self-defense?
You don't bring in extrinsic evidence under the four corners rule.
That's right.
At the pleading stage.
Well, it's the eight corners.
Well, I hear it called four corners. I hear it called eight corners. I think Wisconsin calls it four corners more
often. Well, that's because you're just looking at the complaint.
Yeah, but you do not look at extrinsic evidence at the time of the pleadings. And the reason for that, this is a good example of that, this case. If you look at the pleading in this case, it's very clear that the allegations by the party that's making the claim is that Waterwell did a number of activities, and they installed the pump, they reinstalled, they failed to put the screws in, etc. Now we get an affidavit submitted 6 months after the tender that says, well, Waterwell really didn't do this stuff. A subcontractor did it. Those two are in direct opposite. Okay? So now what are we going to have here if you don't have a four corners? We're going to have to have a whole discovery process on that issue. If they had wanted that, they could have easily pleaded consolidated into the federal court case, and that would have brought the issue ripe right there. The court has indicated, well, what's really the downside for the insurance company of the deny? Here's the downside. One, you don't control the defense. And that can be an expensive proposition depending on attorney's fees and so forth. We see that often. They don't control the defense anymore. Two, if they're wrong, they waive the exclusions. So if additional facts develop later that they could have gotten excluded under, they're still going to provide coverage. And three, in some cases, there's a potential for attorney's fees and the bad faith claim. So there's significant risk. And in fact, I think this court talks about that, that there could be consequences when you decide at the pleading stage.
So is the difference between unilateral and bilateral that in bilateral you could bring in extrinsic evidence?
In bilateral, you're going to have the issue before the court. You're going to have discovery.
Okay, right? That's why I'm asking you. I think that that's what I really heard from you, but I would like it explicit.
Yeah, the difference is you are bringing in extrinsic evidence, but that's really no different than any time as a coverage analysis as facts develop. Mm-hmm. Things can change, more discovery can happen, and the coverage analysis can change. But at the beginning, this court has consistently ruled, you look at, you don't even know what the facts are. You just say what the plaintiff claims, and I thought prior counsel made a great point on that, which is, we're talking about the claim being made here. We're not talking about what actually happened. We're talking about, at that stage, what the claim was. And this court has consistently ruled, because we're not talking about what actually happened, even if what is claimed didn't happen, but it falls within coverage, arguably, you have to defend. I just want to make sure, and I know this court knows that, that really that four corners test has worked to the insured's advantage in almost every case.
Counsel, do you agree that it's the insured's initial burden to show there is a grant of coverage?
I don't know that burden is the right word in this case if we're talking about it in terms of burden of proof, for example. Because
what you have to do is point to an insurance policy, which we interpret as a question of law, and say, oh, this and this and this shows I have coverage, okay? So to point that out, whatever you want to terminate. And then my next question, which is really the one I'm most interested
in,
if there is an initial grant of coverage, who has the obligation to prove there's an exception that lies in this case?
An exception?
Uh-huh.
An exception to the exclusion?
No, an exclusion. An exclusion and the, well, they go together in this
case.
Well,
I know they do, why I tried
that,
to be clear.
That chunk of the puzzle, if you want to bifurcate them, I suppose you can, but here they're kind of stuck together. There's an exclusion from coverage, and then there's an argument from opposing counsel, there's an exception to an exclusion. So, who has the obligation to show that to the court?
Let me make a distinction between that analysis when the tender is just made to the insurance company and when, let's say, we get into litigation over it. When it's made to the insurance company, The insurance company has a good faith responsibility to review and make a determination, do we have coverage under the initial grant of coverage? I mean, that's part of their responsibility. That's what acting reasonably is.
Okay.
They don't really, the insurer doesn't really have to, you know, there's no burden on the insurer. There, the insurer has to look at that. And then the insurer has to look at the rest of the policy.
Okay.
What does the entire policy provide in terms of this tender? Now, if you get to a case like we got here.
So the insurance policy, just to stop you, the insurance company then has to look at the exceptions, the exclusions, and then also at the exceptions to the exclusions
everything.
And decide whether or not they think there's
everything.
Coverage. They look at everything initially, too.
Absolutely. They have to look at, if the allegations are assumed to be true, is there coverage? They can't make a distinction.
Okay.
They look to see whether it's initial grant or do exclusions apply.
Okay.
Are there exceptions to exclusions?
Okay.
Are there endorsements?
There's a difference, though, between taking a look to see if you have a duty to defend, which is broader, than whether you ultimately have coverage versus a determination of coverage at the inception, right?
The facts you consider are different. Because you don't consider the facts. You just consider allegations.
You look at the allegations, look at them pretty broadly, see if there's a duty to defend. I mean, people are using the term coverage, but that can be easy example. Someone alleges both negligent and intentional acts. Insurance company says, we don't cover intentional acts, but at the beginning, you don't know if it's negligent or intentional, right? And so the insurance company's in to defend that.
Absolutely.
One. And then there may be competing defenses and how you work through that and whether or not that's even the kind of case that can be bifurcated for a coverage determination, because sometimes they're also wrapped up in each other that it doesn't really matter. You might as well try the whole thing,
right?
Right. But that's different, how coverage unfolds later once the facts are developed in a summary judgment setting. That's different than looking at the complaint and could you be on the hook here. Right.
And I think what you're pointing out is exactly what I'm trying to say about how it works to the insurance benefit. Because the classic case, which I must have defended 100 of these when I was a younger lawyer. By the way, 1986 is not the old days, which you said earlier. You have an intentional bar fight. You have an intentional and you have negligence action. Because plaintiff's attorneys know this court has made it clear what you have to do with a four corners complaint. And plaintiff's attorneys know and good attorneys know how they have to draft a pleading to engage a duty to defend and then possible coverage later. And what happens in that case, you might have a factual investigation. Insurer might have statements and everything else that says this was clearly intentional acts, but because they can't deny a duty to defend there, they actually have to go not on the facts but on the allegations to protect the insurer, and they defend both claims.
I have one more question to follow up. Chief Justice Rogensack asked you about how do we know subcontractors aren't alleged in here, and I think you addressed that to her satisfaction. How do we know what the property damage is here?
Take a look at paragraph 15 of the underlying complaint.
Right.
And to me, when I did the analysis of this case myself after I got it, this was key because it talked about all the activity, right? It talked about who did what. Talked about the failure to install screws, and it says, as a direct and proximate result of the foregoing, on or about February 6, 2011, the well pump unthreaded, separated from the pipe column, and caused the well pump, including the motor, to fall to the bottom of approximately 1,910-foot deep well. Next paragraph says what their damages are. That clearly says that the damages are to the well pump.
There's well pump was $300,000?
Apparently, according to this complaint.
That's what I'm wondering. If property damage includes more than the well pump. That's what I'm trying to say.
But there's nothing alleged that says the well pump. Anything but the well pump was damaged. So we made it, Consolidated made a determination based on the allegations of the complaint. And again, I think it's important to realize insurance policy is looking at the claim. What's the claim being made? How many times are things claimed that are not accurate later? But at the duty to defend stage, here, what was claimed was the well pump fell to the bottom. and the damages are $300,000. And again, when this was tendered to us, there was no extrinsic evidence provided whatsoever. No letter saying in that tender letter, the tender letter that's in the court record doesn't say anything about, well, we had this other damage. It doesn't provide the invoice that they're talking about in the Judkins affidavit. That isn't provided. So there's no extrinsic evidence in this case that was presented at the time of the tender.
Counsel,
and, yes?
I want to take a bigger picture, and the bigger picture is in part painted by Judge Riley's brief dissent in this case. And he says in part, the Four Corners Rule in paragraph 21, the Four Corners Rule is defined by the majority, allows a litigant who is not a party to a contract of insurance to unilaterally control whether a contract, the insurance policy, provides coverage when that litigant has no privity in the contract. Now, that to me raises a red flag. That's a problem. I mean, that's a problem. You give the example of the bar fight. Well, if someone that did this work couldn't figure out that you have to plead both negligence and intentional, they shouldn't be doing this work. That's an easy thing, you know. I mean, that's the most elementary of examples in my mind. But some of these policies are far from easy. They're nuanced. And so the plaintiff may not know what the buzzwords are or what is necessary. And the issue that Judge Riley raises is, I think, is a legitimate concern. You respond in part, this by and large, this notice pleading and the rules that have existed have inured to the benefit of the insured. I'm thinking about not this past case that we just had of $700,000+, maybe, or this case with hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm thinking about the case that involves $30,000 or $50,000 or $75,000. Tell me how it inures to the benefit of the insured if their options are, number one, bring a loss, hire an attorney, come up with a retainer, make monthly payments for your breach of contract theory. Or hire an attorney, and oftentimes they'll combine, for your bad faith, right? And then you also perhaps have this estoppel or waiver that we talked about in the last case with, you know, the three cases, the Kenefic and Grubin, et cetera. So, if it's a $30,000 or a $50,000 claim, that doesn't benefit anyone. And why should, I'm saying this in a kind of rhetorical fashion, why should what I have as a contract be defined by someone else's pleading who has no privity to contract, Judge Riley's complaint? That resonates. What's wrong? Isn't there something else that should be added when you don't have highfalutin talented attorneys like we have here and are the money to pay for them?
I've got several, I want to respond to that at several levels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
First, with all due respect, Justice Bradley, I don't believe that the situation either described by Judge Riley, who I also have a lot of respect for, had cases with him and against him, is as dire a situation as it talks about. I agree you can come up with that kind of hypothetical. But the fact of the matter is, because this court has been so clear on its Four Corners Rule, and because it generally works to the benefit of the insured, there are very few cases, this is probably the second case I've had in my career, where you actually have a denial based simply on the complaint, a duty to defend denial. Because when you have a more nuanced situation, a more complicated policy, you often have a situation where you also have a more complicated complaint, and you do the second deal. You hire counsel for the insured, and you hire somebody separate to handle the coverage. So that's one thing. I'm not sure that that problem we're discussing is as big a problem. There may be individual situations. Number two, as far as, again, with all due respect to this court, you know, a petition for review is granted, and I would say one of the reasons is to establish a new principle of law on which litigants rely. The Four Corners test here has been working extremely well for a lot of years in this state. Once you start getting outside the pleading, and now we're going to go into, this is my third point, on the facts. What facts are we going to do? If you look at the cases around the country that have adopted something about extrinsic evidence, in each one of those cases, by the way, there was extrinsic evidence in the record on which they could make a change, which we don't have here.
What's wrong with his proposal, an affidavit?
An affidavit from the insured who has a self-interest, obviously, in getting coverage, that is going to be conclusive on whether or not there's a duty to defend? What if you have a complaint, like I argue in this case, that is diametrically opposed to what the insured says, and you have, obviously, the insurance policy and the coverage is set up to handle the claim that is being made. The claim is in the complaint. Now you have an insured with an entirely opposite affidavit. All right, how much further then do we go to make a determination, well, is it the affidavit or is it the complaint? And then it will spurn a whole bunch of other bad faith litigation because you didn't go far enough.
I understand those concerns.
Yeah.
I mean, they are very real. But I also understand the concern that there's a balancing here.
Can I make one fourth point on that, by the way, about the cost to the insured?
Sure.
Quickly.
Make it quick because I have another question.
What would have cost in this case, in the underlying case, the third party in? They had a lawyer. What would have cost them the third party in the insured?
Well, I'm not talking about this case because look at you. I mean, you know, you guys are talented attorneys who can write. I'm talking about the person that this law will apply to, who has a case of $30,000 and an income of $21,000 a year, right? And that's the person I'm talking about. And this rule of law applies to them also. So that's my concern. I wonder how well this Four Corners rule is ensconced, and this is not meant to be rhetorical, and I need a response. And Judge Riley refers to this 2010 certification that this court was on its way to addressing. That is, you know, hey, there are problems with the Four Corners rule, and this certification is going to address it. Just like sometimes happens, the parties voluntarily settled the case. So is it really that well settled, do you think, all of this? We're all happy with it?
All I can say is when I looked at the case law on this, and I've been working with the Four Corners test forever.
Sure, so
if we
have
look
we.
At the Bradley case or the Doyle case in 1998, you were the author of that decision and cited the Four Corners.
Well, I've embraced this thing, okay. You know, in part because it's so darn easy. Look, there has, just as you say, there has to be certainty in this kind of a thing. There has to be rules. There has to be some black and white stuff. And we can't have a lot of satellite litigation. But there also has to be a balancing of not cutting out people and letting them have a claim asserted when they've been paying premiums for it, too.
True, but you also don't want to have a limited exception for a situation that may be rare that will cause more havoc to other insurers. That's my other point. I see that my yellow light is on. I want to make a couple of points. I'm sorry, Justice Press.
Can I ask you just a very simple question? On the facts of this case, if you had been representing Waterwell right at the outset, is there something you could have done within theories that are acceptable to you to get a defense out of the insurer?
Absolutely. If Waterwell supposedly knew they had a subcontractor, why did, you know, they could have brought a third-party complaint, alleged the subcontractor was involved. It would have been very easy to bring Consolidated into the case, and they would have had a whole different situation. We'd never be here. They could have third-partied them in for nothing into that underlying action once the tender was denied.
But Would they have had to provide their own defense?
They already had their own defense.
All
they
right.
had defense. They had the lawyers that were defending them and tendered the defense. They had their own attorneys. They had attorneys who were defending the case. They could have easily.
But how is there any way they could have gotten a defense paid for by the insurer?
If, in fact, and I'm not conceding that what is in that affidavit is, in fact, accurate. But if, in fact, what they say in their affidavit is accurate, and that is somehow not our Waterwell's work and not their product, as soon as they bring that third party in and they get that discovery, and that doesn't take much, they're going to be able to show that it's, the exclusions don't apply, and they're going to get the defense picked up. And that's practically, in the real world, that's exactly what happens. The insurer denies it, and the insured brings them in. That's exactly what happens. So just a couple of points here, really, on what
I'm... If you did what you just suggested in response to Justice Prosser's question, you've changed it from unilateral to bilateral.
Well, now you've got the whole, everything you wanted.
Isn't that right, though?
Yeah, you would have the extrinsic facts. You
right.
would have all that. Although, because of the denial, the insurance company Consolidated now would have, as they did here, had the other risks of exclusions don't apply and so forth.
You make your points, and then I have a question.
Well, a couple of points on the relief sought here. Well, number one, we're asking to affirm the Court of Appeals, obviously. Number two, even if this court makes a decision that extrinsic evidence can now be considered in the Four Corners test, the Court of Appeals should still be affirmed because there is nothing in the record here to show there was any extrinsic evidence at the time of the tender. That's undisputed. And so it would be totally unfair to Consolidated to say, oh, by the way, later on they provided extrinsic evidence and you should have considered that even though it wasn't submitted. So that's our second point. And finally, number three, if the court decides they don't care about my number two, this should be prospectively applied, this case. The standard on that is clear here. Consolidated would have made a decision under existing Four Corners law with no extrinsic evidence. And if the court now says, well, extrinsic evidence should be considered, that as such a change in law would be unfair to hold Consolidated to that standard, even if the court wants to hold that going forward.
I'm looking at the Court of Appeals decision, so it fits in with your points. On paragraph 3, the Court of Appeals says that the circuit court, in making the coverage determination for the purpose of the duty to defend, right, the court must consider all the terms of the insurance policy, including the exclusions. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's the four corners of the complaint and the entire policy.
Right.
And your opponent just wants the coverage parts of the policy, not the exclusions, if I understood that.
Yeah.
The circuit court concluded there was no coverage claim alleged in the underlying complaint because, et cetera, your product and your work exclusions, so no duty to defend, and you agree with them that there's no extrinsic evidence that should be used.
Totally agree.
So you have nothing about the Court of Appeals decision that you would want us to change.
I love the Court of Appeals.
And you think it's consistent with the Court of Appeals in Marx?
Yes.
Okay.
Both very well reasoned and well thought out decisions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
A few quick points. Number one.
Let me just ask you, really,
oh, yeah, sure.
When does extrinsic evidence stop?
Well, I think if you are talking about the proposal that I've just suggested, it would be one time. There would be an opportunity in certain limited circumstances like that are present here where the complaint is unclear or ambiguous or omits important facts that might be relevant to a coverage determination. The insured should be permitted to introduce those facts. Again, I think it's simpler, it's quicker, it's cheaper. The result is not more litigation. The result is less litigation. And it would be, like I said, along the lines of The affidavit would be two or three more paragraphs to, as if the underlying complainant, third-party complainant, had included all the relevant facts. For example, the Judkins affidavit, I respectfully disagree with opposing counsel that it's at odds with anything in the complaint.
But what I think is interesting is that his argument that there was no extrinsic evidence provided to the insurance company at the time of tender because his affidavit is dated June 2nd, 2014. So my question to you is, if I like your rule, when does it begin? Don't you have to give them the extrinsic evidence at the time you make the tender?
We're saying the same thing differently.
Yeah.
Oh, I misunderstood your question then, Justice Ziegler. I think that would be the rule, that I think there would be an option for the insured to provide the affidavit with the tender or in response to an investigation from the insurance company pre-suit, but that if the insurance company still, in the face of the grieve affidavit, whatever we shall call it, continued to deny its duty to defend, the insured would be permitted then to introduce that evidence in court.
That's an interesting theory to me, because really what you're doing is then saying, look, we have liability under your policy. Isn't that at odds with defending the premise of having liability? I mean, what do you do with that affidavit? The complaint doesn't allege it, but you want to introduce an affidavit saying, oh, yeah, I really was negligent, and here's how. You know, so cover me? That's really odd, because then you're really going to bat for the plaintiff.
I don't think
instead of being a defendant.
Right. I'm not suggesting that the affidavit would concede liability. For example, the affidavit in this case didn't concede any liability. It merely identified that there were subcontractors at work that performed some of the work to meet an exception to an exclusion, and it identified product that we didn't supply that was. So that doesn't have anything to do with the underlying liability. It doesn't hurt our position in trying to defend that lawsuit. One point I did want to make about paragraph 15 of the complaint, which is in connection to your product exclusion. It does not allege that the well pump was damaged. It alleges that the well pump fell and that money was paid. It does not say what was repaired. It does not say what was replaced. It does not identify every specific component that was damaged. And by the way, loss of use of the well is a measure of damages under the consolidated policy. So to the extent Argonaut was paying for loss of use of a well, which I think the reasonable inference is if your well pump falls into your well for some period of time, there's a loss of use of that. That would be damage to product that is not ours. Those reasonable inferences, I think, get us out from under any idea that the only thing in the complaint that is alleged is damage to our product. That's simply not a fair reading of the complaint.
Counsel, one thing I'm not understanding, your opposing counsel made the point, gee, if it had been a subcontractor and a matter of some screws, this is something that they would have been able to know at the time of the tender. Why is he wrong that couldn't have been included at the time of the tender?
It could have, but we didn't need it because we win under the strictest interpretation of the Four Corners rule. We were entitled to a defense under a no-exception, absolute bar Four Corners rule, because they're only relying on the your product and your work exclusions. And under our view, we think we win before you reach Grieve or Groove or any of that. So we didn't think we needed it.
Thank you.
I mean, yes, in an ideal world, I suppose an insured would provide it to an insurance company. But I'm confident that the court could fashion, again, an incremental, narrow exception to the Four Corners rule. Most jurisdictions have, even Texas, which is a pretty strict Four Corners rule, has an exception that says you as an insured can submit extrinsic facts that are not inconsistent with the underlying complaint. And I agree that the Four Corners rule does work in a lot of cases. It works in most cases because most insurance companies defend presumably because of these risks, but also because these policies, the CGL policies, are written broadly enough that they would warrant a defense. I see my time is up, and unless there are other questions, I'll take the
seat. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you both. or very, very good arguments, and thank all three of you, I believe, for the work on the briefs. They were really excellent and very helpful to us. So we're going to take a brief break for lunch, and we'll be back at 1:30 for our next case of the day. Thank you very much.